Tonight at 10 o'clock, immediately following this program, PBS television stations will be carrying a point of view documentary, KPFA On the Air, an hour-long documentary on the legendary community radio station. That documentary was made at the time of the 50th anniversary of KPFA, and the history of KPFA is, in essence, the history of community radio in America. Now, for 37 of those 50 years, William Marks Mandel was a commentator on KPFA. Matthew Lazar, in his book Pacifica Radio, wrote of Mr. Mandel that he played a crucial role in the history of Pacifica, and in closing the segment on the head of Pacifica, who expanded it from KPFA alone to include stations in New York and Los Angeles, Lazar writes, "However, Harold Winkler's main contribution to Pacifica history can be summarized in the recruitment of a single man, William Marks Mandel." We're fortunate to have Mr. Mandel here tonight to discuss some of the history that you'll be seeing in the movie coming up. Now, there's a lot more there than can be said in a one-hour documentary film, and certainly more than in this half-hour broadcast. If you want the whole story, Mr. Mandel's view of KPFA as it developed, both in its first decade and before him, and in his nearly 40 years on its air, is set forth in lively detail in his recently published biography, Saying No to Power. It's a beautiful 550-page paperback from Creative Arts, and it's in all the stores. And you can also hear Mr. Mandel reading from that autobiography on internet radio on Monday evenings. Go to www.luver.com for more information on that. Mr. Mandel, thank you for being here this evening. You joined KPFA in 1957?
58.
58. And by 59, you were the most popular commentator on their air. So evidently you were doing something that went straight down the middle of KPFA's mission of serving its audience.
Well, yes, but what made my program essential at that time and what made it popular, granted that I had to be good enough to take advantage of this, is that Sputnik had gone up not long before, and the notion in this country that the Russians could... those mujiks in rag leggings and sandals could beat us into space was simply unthinkable. And the story is rather interesting. This is just after the McCarthy period, with which I had my own experiences. And so when someone said to me, how about, why don't you approach KPFA? I had been on KPFA in its first year. I passed through town in 1950, and it started, it was within the first 12 months. I should be proposed a program on Soviet science, which was quite appropriate in terms of what I just said, and it happened to be the way I was making a living. I'd been blacklisted as a Sovietologist. And the station manager, this man Winkler, to whom Lazar refers, said, do Russian papers come to this country? I said, yes, they do. He said, well, we have shows on the Swedish press and the French press and the British press. Why not do one on the Russian press? I said, marvelous. We were off and running.
The original working title of Lazar's book was From Dialogue to Dissent, and I'm trying to picture the era and what Lewis Hill must have had in mind as a pacifist for dialogue. America and the Soviet Union had just come out of World War II, fighting, if not side by side, at least together in some sense against fascism. At home, we still had a lot of the Franklin Roosevelt, Wendell Willkie-style one-world people in public life.
Amazing to find someone your age who knows the name Wendell Willkie, but he's a very important name. A liberal, a genuinely liberal Republican. I realize that character, that type of person doesn't exist today, but he was the candidate... against Roosevelt.
Well, so it seems there was an entire mood which, if we can even understand it today at all, it at least takes some work to conjure up. The United Nations was brand new, but by the time you joined KPFA, the phrase one world had become disrespected and had distinctly subversive connotations.
Yes.
So was the McCarthy era part of what moved KPFA from dialogue as its primary focus? In that environment, was dialogue any longer possible?
No, no.
What did you find?
No. Dialogue was possible. Hill's view, the founder of listener-sponsored radio, Hill's view was that if we could just get people of different views into a room in front of a microphone to discourse with each other, truth would emerge. And so during those first 10 years, he had committed suicide shortly before I came on the air. During those first 10 years, you would have actual fascists, whether it was the American Nazi Party or something of that kind. There was an occasional communist speaker, and these are not the only issues by any means on which very diverse opinions occurred with respect to homosexuality. At that time, it was the sin that has no name. And these previously undiscussed matters had been discussed on KPFA for a decade. Likewise, the very first interview of a defected FBI man at a time when J. Edgar Hoover was at the right hand of God. So that the function of KPFA as a voice of dialogue was a useful and creative one in many respects. What happened subsequently was that, in the first place, there was the Cold War, which, of course, had existed throughout the entire period. There was the McCarthy period, which I, having gone through it, I'd been before the so-called McCarran Committee. This is the committee that later called KPFA itself, the Senate Internal Security Subcommittee. I'd been before them in 1952, specifically for writing a book called The Soviet Far East and Central Asia, obviously subversive. And the next year I was before Joe McCarthy for exactly the same reason. It was clear to me that by 58, 59, things had eased up considerably, but most of the population didn't know it, those who had not been had to face this directly. So that when in 1960, at the beginning of 1960, black kids in the South sat down to be served a cup of coffee and had their heads beaten in for that, when also in 1960 a strong movement occurred right here in Berkeley, San Francisco, against the death penalty, a talented writer who was a murderer was to be executed, and this is the first large movement against capital punishment. And when finally, in April of 1960, 40 people were called before the House Un-American Activities Committee in San Francisco, including myself. And it happened, to my regard, this is good luck, most people regard it very differently, but it happened that that occurred at exactly the time when students decided they don't want to go on in the 1950s style of conforming. They did not want to confine themselves to coloring within the lines. So that when the police then responded by washing the students down the stairs, a magnificent scene, the City Hall of San Francisco, the stairs are designed to make for this dramatic kind of thing, almost like the Odessa steps in the film Potemkin. This brought into existence a movement of dissent. The blacks in the South, also the movement against the bomb, and the movement against UAC. And the question then was, how should KPFA proceed? There were two of us in the station who very much wanted it to be the voice of dissent. One was a remarkable woman, long deceased, Elsa Knight Thompson, who, an American who had spent many years in England, had gotten a job with BBC at a time when women were a very rare sight or voice on the airwaves. A meticulous broadcaster. People tell me, Lazar tells me, that she insisted that in seeing everything that went on the air before it went on the air, I was an exception to that rule. I was totally unaware of that until Lazar told me that in writing his book a couple of years ago. Elsa and I were very close. We had never met previously. She was maybe 15 or 20 years older than I. And she was, I don't know whether she would define herself politically in any way. I, at that time, was an independent Marxist. I'd been a member of the Communist Party in earlier years. And she certainly had ideas that in England would have been those, because she had spent years there, at the left end of the Labour Party. The left end of the British Labour Party in those years had strong Marxist influences. So that Elsa, this crack-the-whip boss of the Public Affairs Department, and I had a lot of prestige for my show, as you've mentioned. By 1959, it was the most popular show on the air at our station. And I had a similar show on KQED at that time. One of the strange things about tonight's show over KQED is that the present staff there doesn't know that I had a show there for 3 years and that it was ended when I appeared before the House Un-American Activities Committee. The program director came to me and said, Bill, I'm not a very courageous person. Your show will not be renewed next year. Man tells you he's a coward, there isn't much you can do. So between, and what really changed things, there were several things. One day, Elsa called a meeting of the public affairs broadcasters. There were 13 of us there. And I looked around the room. By the way, we were all male except for Elsa. I looked around the room, and this is a little bit later. This is because this change of the station took place between 1960 and 1965-66. The free speech movement, I happen to have been a member of its executive committee, although I wasn't associated with the university. The free speech movement, then I taught at the university later, the free speech movement occurred in 64-65, and when it was over and had won, there happened to be a meeting of the public affairs department, 13 of us. I looked around the room and I said, is there anyone here under 40? Well, one man who was 39, who is now an emeritus professor, Marshall Miller, who I thought, by the way, was the most popular broadcaster on the station until the survey was taken. Wynn Miller was the one person under 40. I said, this is preposterous. I said, the kids are turning the country and the world upside down. We must get younger people in here. And remember that the station had been founded by people, by and large, under 35, people of draft age, 30th, people who had been of draft age during World War II. But they had gotten older over this period of time, over these 20 years. So I said, we have to make room for young people, and I'll be happy to give up half of my time if that's necessary. Well, they didn't find it necessary, and they did bring young people on in large numbers. The young people were in a mood of dissent, which not only extended through the 60s, but actually was the cause of a great deal of difficulty at the station in the 70s. When the 60s ended, 60s activists who had not had my experience, my age, I'm 83, and so I was a 30s activist, and I knew that the 30s came to an end. The 60s activists had no notion the 60s would ever come to an end. I didn't want them to, but I understood when it happened. And so when it did happen, the station was torn apart by those who wanted to go on in a mood that no longer corresponded to the mood of the country, and those who felt that a more sober approach should be taken. At all events, this is the story.
So you're describing a period where more different kinds of people were coming on the air.
Right.
Now, if we go back and look at the print media in the 50s, 60s, 70s, one of the things that strikes me about the 50s is that there's a conformity of appearance,
right,
including in the dissenters, no matter what viewpoint they were expressing. They were all essentially looking like the same kinds of people. By more recent times, you begin to see at KPFA, but also in the movement generally, less emphasis on a diversity of opinion, or maybe a belief that you couldn't have diversity of opinion, honestly, unless you had a diversity of individuals.
Mm-hmm.
And that diversity would be defined, at least in the first place, in terms of gender and race.
Yes.
Is that right?
Well, right is something I was very conscious of and played some role in. There was a point, I don't remember whether the gender or race issue, which one came first. I think the race issue came first, because these things arose at pretty much the same time. The station had always been very good at standing up for the rights of African Americans. This is the chief issue at that time, and to a lesser degree, remember, we're Northern California, not Southern. The Latino population here was not that large at that time, although it certainly existed, particularly in San Francisco. And we were the first station to, maybe the only station, but certainly the first, to give Huey Newton time on the air. And despite the fact that Huey Newton and the Panthers very regrettably descended into something reflecting the conditions under which they had been raised, ultimately. But they were militant people who did not only stood up to the police, which was exceedingly important, to break an attitude of fear. For let's understand that as far as black people were concerned, the situation in this country was fascist. That has to be understood. And at all events, there was a proposal that a third world department be established at the station.
At what time was this?
Roughly 66. I don't have the papers in front of me. Roughly 66. That a third world department should be established. And the question then arose as to when its time should be. I felt that it should get the best time we had. In those years, radio was not yet a drive-time phenomenon. So the best time we had was the news, and no one proposed, and I did not propose, changing the news. But the best time after that, which was the time I had, was immediately following the news. So everyone agreed this is a white station. We had an Ethiopian-American as announcer. We employed an announcer in those years, but that was his sole function. Everyone else on the station was white. And there was this roadblock as to when time should be given to the Third World Department. And I simply said that, I'll give up my spot right after the news, which is the best of all possible times. And I said, I propose that we give the 7 o'clock spot across the board, Monday through Friday, to the Third World Department. And of course, that meant giving up my own spot. Inasmuch as everybody agreed that it should be established, and inasmuch as it was clear to everyone that I was giving up my coveted spot, this went through. And so the Third World Department got the 7 o'clock spot across the board. That didn't last forever. There were all kinds of further complexities and problems. That was the situation. As far as women were concerned, the new women's movement started in 66, so this probably was a couple of years later. I think it was as late as 1970. I'm speaking from memory now. Women had, there was one point at which a couple of women actually sat in and took over the station without much effect, but this was the strength of feeling. And finally, Laura X, who is the founder of the Women's History Research Library and the person responsible for the laws against marital rape that now exist in every state of the Union. She simply fought it through. Laura and her research library prepared a program for me one evening. I did this program, and my program, remember, was on the Soviet Union, although I was not until this latest period in KPFA history, the 1990s, did anyone raise any question whatever if a regular programmer, particularly a popular one, digressed totally from his or her assigned subject matter.
But I feeling being that the Soviet Union would still be there next week.
Yeah, exactly. In those years, I was taken for granted. And the consequence was that I did this program, which I assume included, I think it was a comparative situation, the American situation and the Russian situation. And when it was over, in the phone-in period, and I'm the reinventor of talk radio, I thought I was the inventor, but Mr. Lazar discovered that before McCarthyism, there actually had been one or two stations that allowed listeners to phone in. I was totally unaware of that. And during the phone-in period, I deliberately said, kind of odd that a person like me, I was referring to my gender, should be doing this kind of program. Well, the station manager of that day was outraged that I mentioned a station problem, the problem of who does what, on the air. But both the mood at the station, very different from today, and the strength of the women's movement was such that within a very short period after that, women's programming was initiated. In both the case of Third World programming and women's programming, obviously the Third World people and the women were the main forces in instituting that. What I contributed was both the standing I had on the station and the fact that I simply laid it on the line and, in the former case, put my own time up for grabs. At all events, that's how these things came into being.
Now, you're alluding to a decision-making process at KPFA. How has that decision-making process changed, and is that reflected in the programming, or is it a separate evolution?
Now or then?
Well, I'm thinking about differences between now and, say, the 60s and 70s.
Okay.
And in the 50s, okay. If it says anything useful about where we are today.
Okay. In the first place, KPFA has never been a peaceful place. No one quite knows whether Lou Hill's suicide, this was 57, the year before I came on the scene, was a consequence of his terribly painful rheumatoid arthritis or of the very severe differences at the station. The problem there was that when somebody has an idea of genius, the whole notion of the station was Lou Hill's notion, the whole notion that listeners would pay to hear what they could hear free of charge. There were severe battles, and in subsequent years they took on different forms. I was always under attack from the right and the left. sects do not like apostates. I was an ex-communist, which meant now on the East Coast, that meant the communists wouldn't talk to me. On the other side, obviously, since I favored, always did favor, a peaceful coexistence, I was totally against the Cold War, I thought it was unnecessary and wrong, the right attacked me. So, and this was reflected to a small degree in the station. There were one or two of the old-timers in the station. By old-timers, I mean people of Lou Hill's generation. They weren't. They might have been there about my age, but they were in the station 10 years earlier. Who Bob Schutz, particularly, whom you'll see in the film tonight. I was extremely left from Bob's point of view, and Bob was a figure of significance in the station. So there was that. Likewise, Elsa Knight Thompson, for whom I have the greatest admiration, was hell on wheels as an executive, and regrettably was very, very severe with young women. It just happened. So these are realities. So that in the as time went on, well, let me give you the background, which is much more important. The background is that the Pacifica Foundation, which is the seat of the difficulties that KPFA has today, Pacifica Foundation always had ultimate power at the station. It was a license holder. It was simply established. It was simply a legal form. But the form as it existed gave them total power, which in those years they never exercised. The members of the board understood perfectly well that, as in so many nonprofit organizations, their job was to be a respectable front. I don't mean a front for anything bad. I mean they were the most very respectable citizens of standing. Their job was to help raise money, which is a very, very common thing in nonprofit organizations. And therefore, they permitted the station managers and the executive director of the system to run the system. That was number one. Number two, there were two strikes at the station, one over firing Elsa. The second strike specifically enshrined in the agreement, it was over union recognition, and a union was established. It enshrined the notion that those of us who were not paid, I was never paid, 37 years on the air, I was never paid, and at the lowest estimate, it was worth a couple of $1 million in the cheapest rate of pay for radio work. The union agreement specified that the people who worked without reimbursement were not to be called volunteers. We were unpaid staff. So as to establish total equality between the paid staff, there were certain about 20 people necessary, and about 200 of us were unpaid staff. What was most interesting, and this always occurred, and I realized it quite early, and this helped me ride out a number of storms, I pointed it out to people. Even though you had this recognition of unpaid staff, the paid staff very normally regarded those people they saw each day as the people who were the station. For example, I was in only once a week. I came in, did a show, and went home. I enjoyed a somewhat special status, but nonetheless, I was typical in the general sense of unpaid staff. I did my thing. Others were broadcasters like myself. Others did every conceivable kind of office work or even technical work. But like myself, they had to make a living differently, and maybe they didn't have my energy, so they didn't put in the amount of time I did. The consequence was that decisions were made by those who were physically present in the station, which was the paid staff plus those unpaid staff who came in fairly regularly almost every day. Some people did. So the paid staff did not point his finger and say, hey, you're not paid, you don't count. But in effect, the division was paid staff versus unpaid staff because only a very few of the 200 unpaid staff were economically in a position to come in during the day. That situation has existed throughout the station's history and exists right now, and frankly, it's one of the causes of the disagreements as to how to conduct the struggle against Pacifica, which is the issue at KPFA at this moment.
We have a couple of minutes left. I'd like to look into the future and the so-called new media. We think of the internet as being democratic, but computers cost money. When you started at KPFA, FM was sort of a snob medium, and you had to give away the receivers.
Didn't give them away.
No?
No. We sold them for $10, which, by the way, is a couple of hundred in today's money.
All right. So there have been, then as now, financial barriers to these allegedly democratic media. What media do you think are going to be important in getting the word out in a democratic way?
They are all important and useful. At this moment, the internet is certainly the freest medium there is. Anyone can broadcast. The station I broadcast on, Lover, L-U-V-E-R, is run by an extraordinary man, severely disabled, with cerebral palsy, can't speak, can't take care of his bodily functions. The man is a philosopher, the man is a good poet, the man is upbeat, believe it or not. He not only runs a station, he teaches other people how to run it. Extraordinary. He lives on SSI, so, you know, supplemental Social Security. So that remarkable possibility exists. Now, for example, there's another device. When KPFA let me go 5 years ago, I was immediately offered time on a licensed station in the South Bay, where I broadcast for a couple of years, and also on an unlicensed station, what we call pirate stations. That was Berkeley, Free Radio Berkeley. It was taken off the air by injunction. I offered to go to jail to, if need be, to fight this, and things didn't move in that direction. It's a complicated story we don't have time for here. Then some of the people who've been associated with established Berkeley Liberation Radio. So at this moment, there still are a substantial number of these unlicensed stations, and a rather remarkable thing occurred. Our fight, certainly Steve Dunifer here in Berkeley was the key figure in this entire movement, our fight did win a ruling by the FCC under which it will for the first time grant licenses to stations of down to 100 watts. Now, let me explain. The opening words of the basic law on radio in this country is very much like the Declaration of Independence. The air waves belong to the people. Those are the words. And the rest of the law goes on to take the airwaves away from you. They set up the Federal Communications Commission, which simply arbitrarily, not as a law but as a rule, which it established, refused to grant licenses to stations under 1,000 watts, if I remember correctly, but certainly not at 100. They simply were not giving licenses to low-power stations. The function of a low-power station is to be a community station in the real sense. For example, Berkeley Liberation Radio broadcasts at a wattage that enabled it to be heard almost exactly within the limits of the city of Berkeley. This is the purpose of these stations. I've seen a video about them nationally. There's at least one place in Texas where the fire department regards it as an important medium for reaching the public for various things, other such devices. Then, of course, there are the FM stations as such. These five Pacifica stations, or at least three of them, are very powerful stations. KPFA is 59,000 watts, which is a big bugger. We can be heard in the Sierra foothills. I had regular long-time listeners up in the Sierra foothills. We can be heard up to Mendocino if you put an antenna up in a tree. We can be heard down to, I visited a prisoner in Soledad for a number of years and gave him the best radio I could buy, and he was able to get KPFA down there south of Salinas. So that this is a very powerful station. The New York station is also a powerful station. KPFK also is. I don't know the wattage of the Washington and Houston stations. We have the potential of reaching these stations, cover a territory that is inhabited by a minimum of 20 million people, in point of fact, probably a good deal more than that. And obviously, to maintain these stations as stations independent of any political party, I mention this because my take on the effort of the leadership of Pacifica right now to run the stations is to make the stations a tail to the Democratic Party. These stations are a remarkable resource for true independence. And I certainly think that's why this fight is worthwhile. That's why last week's news that the Attorney General of the state of California, who, by the way, 40 years ago was a member of SLATE, the liberal militant student organization at Cal, he has just given the go-ahead to a suit filed by KPFA and other listeners saying, yes, they do have standing to sue, and so Pacific will have to resist. So to my mind, there is room for all of these. There's room for, of course, for the internet, and for low-power community stations, and for, quote, legal, close quote, stations. Obviously, all stations should be legal. The only restriction should be that of actual interference. In that sense, the government, to my mind, has a legitimate role to play in making sure you don't set up in business in a way that cuts out the range of an existing station.
And with that, we return to the mission of radio, who owns the airwaves, and why we even bother to have public radio. You've given us a beautiful framework for understanding the movie. Let's go watch it. Thank you very much, Bill Mandel.
Thank you very much indeed. Good night.
Bill Mandel's autobiography, Saying No to Power, is in the bookstores, and he also has a website you can visit, www.billmandel.net. This interview was conducted at Urban Decay Studios in Berkeley, California. I'm David Aragon.